When you turn on the tap in your kitchen, you really just expect clean water.
Right. It's a given.
Yeah, it's a baseline assumption of living in a modern society. You don't, brace yourself for mud to come pouring out.
Oh, definitely not.
And you certainly don't perform like a chemical analysis before making your morning coffee. You just hold your glass under the faucet, turn the handle, and you just trust it.
You trust the system.
Exactly. You trust this massive invisible infrastructure that brings that water right into your home.
Which is actually, when you think about it, a really profound level of blind faith. I mean, you are trusting the reservoir, the miles and miles of underground pipes, the municipal treatment plant, all without a single conscious thought.
Yeah, we never think about it. But imagine a scenario where maybe over months or even years, that water just got a little murkier, right? A little more bitter every single day.
Gradual change.
Right. The shift is so gradual, you might just brush it off at first. Like, oh, I just need to change my water filter more often.
Or you start boiling it just to be safe.
Yeah. But eventually you reach this breaking point where you're hauling entire cases of bottled water into your house just to brush your teeth.
Wow. Yeah.
Because the very thing that is meant to sustain life has basically become completely toxic.
I mean, that imagery, that gradual compounding contamination you're talking about, it is probably the most accurate way to describe what has happened to the infrastructure of human communication.
Ooh, yeah.
Because we rely on language just as much as we rely on water. It is literally the currency of every relationship, every business deal, every societal structure. But the pipes have completely rusted out.
They really have.
Yeah.
And on that note, I want to offer a very warm welcome to all of our beloved family members joining us for this exploration today.
Okay.
We're stepping into some deep waters here.
We really are.
Our mission today is to unpack a profoundly challenging sermon. It's centered entirely on Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. Specifically, we're looking at Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 through 37.
A really heavy passage.
It is. And the central tension driving this entire sermon is that exact water tap problem we just talked about. We are living in an era that is absolutely flooded with words.
So many words.
Unprecedented volume, right? Yet we have literally never found it harder to actually trust what anyone is saying.
Yeah, that's the core of it. And to understand the sheer weight of what this sermon is arguing, we really have to establish how Jesus operated as a teacher.
Right.
Because the Sermon on the Mount is so frequently misunderstood, people tend to view it as just a list of external behavioral modifications.
Like a new set of community guidelines or something.
Exactly, like terms of service you just click agree to, but it operates much more like an MRI machine.
Or like a.
Yeah, because Jesus isn't really interested in outward compliance. He is using these teachings as this razor-sharp diagnostic tool to expose the hidden inner self.
Okay, let's unpack this because the sermon gives a really striking example of how that diagnostic tool works in real time. It brings up the ancient commandment, do not murder.
Oh.
And outwardly, the bar for keeping that specific commandment is set comfortably low for the average person.
You'd hope so, yeah.
Right. I mean, you can go through your entire life without physically ending someone else's life,
Yeah.
and you feel this sense of moral accomplishment, like, hey, I followed the rule, I'm a good person.
You get to walk around feeling totally justified because, well, you haven't committed the ultimate physical transgression.
Exactly.
But Jesus just completely shatters that metric. He argues that the physical act of murder is really just the final. Yes, he equates the internal private feelings of contempt, deep-seated bitterness, and unrighteous anger to the very root of murder itself.
Wow.
So the standard completely shifts from the action of your hands to the condition of your heart.
And what's terrifying about that is how it just removes any space for us to hide.
Yeah.
I mean, we can mask our internal contempt behind a polite smile at a dinner party, but the underlying reality remains totally unchanged.
Yeah. What's fascinating here is how directly that internal versus external dynamic maps onto our current crisis of communication.
Oh, yeah.
Because outwardly, we look incredibly connected. I mean, we are broadcasting our thoughts, publishing our opinions, typing out messages at a rate that would just baffle any previous
We
generation.
look highly functional.
We really do. But inwardly, the sermon argues that our language is severely polluted by manipulation and deceit.
And the sermon prints to the everyday reality of this pollution. And honestly, once you see it, you cannot unsee it.
Oh, absolutely.
Take the political arena, for instance. We are just constantly subjected to these empty, grandiose promises during every election cycle.
Right. The language is entirely designed to evoke a massive emotional response.
Yeah, but we have reached this point of collective cynicism where we don't actually expect the politician to follow through.
Yeah.
The lie is basically priced into our expectation.
We've just accepted that political language is a performance.
Exactly. And then, you know, you apply that same lens to the corporate world. We are bombarded with exaggerated advertising and products that promise to totally revolutionize our lives.
But we inherently know we have to read the microscopic fine print.
Right. Because the bold claims on the billboard are more than likely hiding a contradictory truth. So we are constantly playing defense against the language being directed at us.
And the cognitive load of that is just exhausting.
It really is.
And the sermon pushes this even further into our modern technological landscape, bringing up our current environment of artificial intelligence and virtual reality.
Oh, man, yeah. The deepfakes.
Right. We are navigating these spaces where the line between an authentic human voice and an artificially generated deepfake is basically evaporating.
It's scary.
It is. You can literally watch a video of a person speaking and still have to question the fundamental reality of what you were seeing.
Yeah. And when the environment is that saturated with artificiality and deceit, our own internal baseline for truth just it begins to warp.
Because we adapt to our environment, right?
Right.
When the natural weight of our everyday words is stripped away by this cultural pollution, humans will instinctively search for a way to compensate.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. So if my casual yes no longer carries any authority because, well, we live in a culture of liars, I have to find a way to artificially inflate the value of my words just to make you believe me.
And this lands us directly on the core focus of the sermon, which is Jesus's famous command in Matthew 5. Do not swear at all.
Yes.
The passage talks about not swearing by heaven or by the earth or by Jerusalem. He systematically dismantles the whole practice of oath-taking.
He really goes after it.
But I have to ask a logistical question here, because historically, there were religious groups who read this text and took it as like an absolute legal prohibition.
Right, the Quakers and others.
Yeah, they would refuse to take oaths in a court of law or swear on a Bible during civic duties. So is this sermon advocating for our beloved family members to boycott legal oaths when they get called for jury duty?
That is a vital distinction to make, because the text definitely has been utilized that way in the past. But the sermon clarifies that Jesus was not delivering a lecture on civic jurisprudence or dismantling formal legal procedures.
Okay.
He was addressing the everyday casual habits of the human heart. You see, in the first century, there was this complex, almost gamified system of oath-taking.
Gamified? How so?
Well, people would swear by the temple or by the gold of the temple or by their own heads. It was essentially the sliding scale of honesty.
Oh, like a loophole system.
Exactly.
So if I swear by heaven, it doesn't count as much as I swear by God himself.
Precisely. It allowed people to craft these illusions of truthfulness while basically keeping an escape hatch open.
Wow.
So the command to not swear at all is really an assault on this habit of constantly needing to guarantee your words because your character alone is too weak to back them up. It is a call to restore baseline unadorned honesty to our everyday conversations.
You know, that dynamic totally reminds me of trying to save a ruined meal.
Okay, tell me more.
Like, imagine you're cooking, but you realize halfway through that the ingredients you bought are spoiled. The meat is low quality. The vegetables are bland and mushy. You can't serve it as is.
Right, it would be terrible.
Right. So what is the defense mechanism? You completely overseason it. You drown the dish in hot sauce, heavy spices, salt, just to mask the fact that the core substance of the meal is terrible.
That is a phenomenal way to understand the mechanics of the oath.
Yeah, making these elaborate casual oaths like swearing on your mother's grave, swearing by the heavens, or casually throwing God's name into your promises to a friend, it's exactly like overseasoning a bad meal.
Spot on.
We are taking God's name and using it as a heavy spice to aggressively cover up our claims.
Yeah.
And we only do that when we know deep down that our own words lack the basic substance of truth.
Mm.
Because if the ingredients are high quality, the food stands on its own. If our words are true, they don't require some cosmic guarantee.
And the sermon dives deep into the psychological underpinnings of this exact mechanism. Like, why do we feel compelled to leverage the divine for our mundane conversations?
Right. Why do we go there?
It's because we are using God's name as a tool of manipulation.
Ouch.
Yeah. We want to borrow God's unquestionable authority to win a petty argument, to force our desires onto someone else, or, you know, just to close a deal. It isn't an act of reverence at all. It is an act of cornering the other person.
We are essentially weaponizing the divine reputation to cover our own lack of credibility.
Yes. And the underlying reason we demand these oaths from others and feel forced to make them ourselves is rooted in this deep-seated anxiety and a pervasive distrust of one another.
Because we assume everyone is lying.
Exactly. We swear because we assume the other person is already evaluating us as a liar. And we demand oaths because we are projecting our own untruthfulness onto them.
Yeah.
The very existence of the casual oath is a blazing warning sign of a society that has completely lost the capacity for trust.
So what does this all mean? I mean, the sermon doesn't just diagnose the problem. It forces us to look at the collateral damage of living in a society built on this foundation of mutual suspicion.
Right.
Because when our baseline communication is corrupted, everything built on top of it becomes incredibly fragile.
It really does.
The sermon actually points to the reality of modern vows, even the most sacred ones like marriage, noting how easily they are discarded today.
It is a tragic paradox, isn't it? We demand higher and more elaborate levels of guarantees from each other, yet we demonstrate increasingly lower levels of commitment to actually keeping them.
Exactly. Language was originally designed as a tool for connection.
Yeah. Right?
A way to build shared understanding.
Yes.
But the sermon observes that language has radically devolved into a weapon for combat.
Oh, you see it everywhere.
Vividly. Just look at any online comment section or a social media thread. It is completely saturated with violent, toxic, polarizing rhetoric.
We are no longer talking to each other. We are verbally striking each other.
Yes. We use extreme hyperbole and absolute statements to just crush the opposition, rather than doing the hard, vulnerable work of finding shared truth.
And the antidote presented in the sermon, which draws from Matthew 5.37 and James 5.12 philo, cuts completely against the grain of that toxic culture.
It really does.
Jesus offers a solution that is breathtaking in its simplicity. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one.
There is so much power in that restraint. The sermon argues that the true mark of a disciple isn't the ability to craft this airtight, convincing argument filled with elaborate modifiers.
Right. You don't need a legal team for your casual chat.
Exactly. We don't need to say, I swear to you 1,000,000%, on everything I love, I will be there. The mark of a disciple is the unadorned honesty to state things exactly as they are.
It is the ultimate display of internal security. When you realize you no longer have to manage a complex, exhausting web of exaggerations, half-truths, and grandiose guarantees, I mean, it is incredibly liberating.
It has to be.
A simple yes is a complete sentence. A simple no is a complete sentence.
Why? Yeah.
But speaking, that simply requires immense integrity, because you are stripping away all the rhetorical armor and relying entirely on the weight of your character.
And that shift from the volume of our rhetoric to the weight of our character moves the sermon into a much heavier spiritual reality.
Yeah, it gets deep here.
We aren't just talking about the social consequences of lying anymore, like how it adds stress to our lives or damages our politics.
Yeah.
We are talking about the eternal implications of our vocabulary.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the spiritual stakes are really monumental.
Yeah. The sermon brings up the story of the Tower of Babel from Genesis, which is just a perfect illustration of this principle.
Right. Humanity attempting to build a massive tower to the heavens.
Exactly. Entirely fueled by their own pride and self-sufficiency. God intervenes to stop the project, but he doesn't physically destroy the tower.
He confuses their language.
Right. And the sermon makes this profound connection. The corruption of language is the direct mechanism that destroys relationships.
Because without shared trust, the project collapses.
Yes. Once they could no longer speak truthfully and clearly to one another, the trust evaporated, humanity fractured, and they scattered.
The architecture of any relationship or any society relies entirely on mutual understanding. When you corrupt the definitions, the structure falls.
It's inevitable.
And the sermon amplifies this by referencing Romans chapter 3, which describes the unredeemed human condition by stating that the poison of asps is under our lips.
Like snake venom.
Exactly. Our natural inclination is to use words that carry a toxic, destructive payload.
And then Jesus delivers one of his most sobering warnings in Matthew chapter 12. He states that we will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every empty, careless word we have spoken.
Every careless word.
Think about the sheer volume of words we throw away without a second thought.
Oh, we treat words like completely disposable commodities.
We really do.
The casual gossip we participate in, the slight exaggerations we use to make ourselves look just a little better in a story, the casual promises we make to a friend that we literally have no intention of keeping.
And the chilling reality this sermon forces us to confront is that our words do not just evaporate into thin air once they leave our mouths.
Yeah, they don't.
They carry eternal weight. God remembers the mundane conversations we've completely forgotten.
Because our words reveal the actual condition of our hearts, and the sermon draws a very direct line between this eternal reality and our current mandate as disciples.
Right.
If we compromise our truthfulness in these small daily interactions, we completely forfeit our right to be witnesses for Christ.
I mean, if I know you constantly exaggerate the details of your weekend, or if you promise to send an email and you never do, why would I ever trust you when you try to explain the profound truths of the gospel?
Exactly.
The platform of credibility has already been dismantled by 1,000 tiny lies.
A witness in a courtroom is only valuable if their testimony is completely reliable. If their story is full of contradictions and hyperbole, the judge strikes it from the record.
Right, it's useless.
In the exact same way, the core of discipleship requires total alignment between what we proclaim about God and how we actually speak in our daily lives.
So we need to bring this high-stakes theology down to the ground for our beloved family members.
Yes, let's make it practical.
We have examined the disease, right? The polluted cultural landscape, the psychology of empty oaths, the destructive nature of our rhetoric. How do we actually live out the cure? How do we begin to close this gap between what we say and what we do?
Well, the sermon offers a brilliant contrast to help us navigate this. On one side, you have the hypocrite.
Okay.
And the hypocrite is fundamentally driven by insecurity. They are terrified of being exposed, so they constantly issue grand, sweeping promises they know they can't keep simply to manage their public image in the present moment.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The true alternative to the hypocrite isn't someone who aggressively advertises their honesty.
No, not at all.
The defining characteristic of a truly honest person is that they don't have to try so hard to look honest. They don't need like a PR campaign for their integrity.
They just let their actions absorb the weight of their words.
Yes.
They simply keep their small promises. They show up to the meeting when they said they would. They pay back the small amount of money they borrowed. They deliver the project on the day they promised.
It's so basic.
It is. It isn't flashy and it rarely gets celebrated, but that quiet, mundane faithfulness is literally the only thing that builds an unbreakable foundation of trust.
And the sermon shares an incredible historical anecdote that perfectly captures how difficult this mundane faithfulness actually is. It looks at the life of St. Augustine.
Yes.
Here is a man who possessed one of the most brilliant architectural minds in church history, yet he wrestled deeply with this exact issue. He constantly prayed to be freed from his own hypocritical desires.
It is a stunning admission from someone of his stature.
It really is.
Augustine recognized the intoxicating temptation to perform for others, to subtly manipulate his language, to appear slightly more holy, more committed, and more truthful to his peers than he actually was in private.
And if a towering intellectual like Augustine had to actively pray for deliverance from his own internal spin doctor, it exposes how deeply ingrained this habit of image management is within all of us.
Absolutely, all of us.
Overcoming it requires immense humility and a willingness to take absolute responsibility for our words.
And that leads to the ultimate challenge of the sermon. We have to put our words into action even when it results in personal pain.
Mm-hmm.
The scriptures talk about the righteous person as someone who swears to their own hurt and does not change.
It's the moment of friction, isn't it? Like you commit to helping a friend move. And the morning of, you're exhausted, it's raining, and you realize it's going to cost you an entire day of rest.
Ugh, we've all been there.
Right. And the cultural instinct is to manufacture a convenient excuse, to use a careless word to escape the commitment.
Just shoot a text saying you're sick.
Exactly. But the disciple follows through anyway. You absorb the inconvenience, the financial loss, or the exhaustion, specifically to preserve the integrity of your word.
Because ultimately, trust is the only foundation upon which our families, our communities, and our society can survive.
Right.
When we stop taking the hit to protect our truthfulness, trust crumbles and everything else collapses right along with it.
It really transforms how we view our daily vocabulary. Our words are not cheap sound bites. They are the literal building blocks of our character.
They are.
Well, beloved family members, as we bring this exploration to a close, the major takeaway is that reducing the gap between our language and our reality is not some quick fix.
No, it's a process.
It is the lifelong work of discipleship. It is a daily, sometimes hourly decision to choose the quiet simplicity of truth over the immediate convenience of a well-crafted exaggeration.
I want to leave our beloved family members with a final provocative thought to mull over as you navigate the week ahead.
I love this.
Imagine this scenario. If the air around you suddenly crystallized and kept a permanent, visible record of every single casual yes and no you uttered over the next 7 days.
Oh, wow.
Right. Would you be proud of the life those words built, or would you find yourself trapped inside a maze of your own empty promises?
That is an incredibly vivid image that will absolutely stick with you the next time you open your mouth to speak.
I know it will for me.
Thank you to all our beloved family members for joining us to explore this sermon. We hope it challenges your daily habits just as much as it challenged ours.
Yes, definitely.
As you step back out into the flood of words in the world today, we encourage you to try something radical. Practice simple, unseasoned honesty in your very next conversation. Let your yes be yes, and let your no be no.